From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
In the mid-1990s, six doctors and clinic workers were murdered in America. In Absolute Convictions, A.L. Press, the son of an abortion provider in Buffalo, New York, explains why his father decided to keep his practice open after one of his colleagues was killed, even after he received a message that he was the next target. The book is published by Henry Holt, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Press to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
You begin with an account of the 1998 shooting of Dr. Barnett Slepian in Buffalo, New York. Did you know Dr. Slepian?
I didn't know him personally, but I knew who he was. I'd heard his name. My father mentioned his name many times. My father and Dr. Slepian knew each other both as professional colleagues and also because for years they were both targeted, starting in the late 1980s in Buffalo, because they both were OBGYNs who performed abortions.
So they compared notes? They would call each other?
Well, the interesting thing is that their closest work together had nothing to do with abortions. It had to do with delivering babies and covering for each other on some weekends. And as I say in the opening scene in the book, on the night he was murdered, Dr. Slepian actually called our home just to check in. It was a Friday night. He was on his way to Temple. My mother took the call. Then he went to Temple. He came home. He heated up some soup in the microwave, and then he was shot and killed.
Both your father and Dr. Slepian were Jewish. Your father actually grew up in Israel. So did that play a part in his attitude about dealing with these death threats?
Very much so. I think particularly initially, you know, my father was born in Jerusalem in 1940 and has the kind of very typical stoic mentality of that generation, someone who was raised to believe that particularly when someone that threatens you, that you should do what you believe is right, regardless of the risks and sacrifices. So here he is. He comes to America thinking he's temporarily leaving this war-torn environment. He winds up in Buffalo, and 15 years later, he sees very intense threats directed at him.
Were there many abortion providers practicing in Buffalo in the late 1990s? Because I think I've read somewhere that Buffalo had been a magnet for abortion seekers before Roe v. Wade.
It was a magnet, like all of New York State was a magnet before 1973, because New York had legalized abortion in 1970. And actually, if Roe is overturned, it's very likely we'll see something similar, where you'll have a lot of women traveling across state lines into cities like Buffalo or in states where abortion remains legal. So yes, that was very much the case. My father, it turns out, arrives in Buffalo just a few weeks after Roe, and in many places in the country, what doctors then saw was this influx of women suddenly showing up at hospitals to have pregnancy terminations. In Buffalo, it was the opposite, because there were so many women from out of state that had come that it actually was sort of a temporary reduction in the demand.
So why do you think Dr. Slepian was singled out, and why was your father also targeted?
Well, as I trace in the book the various kind of forces that I think coalesced to make Buffalo a real center of activism and protest against abortion, one of those facts was that the city is heavily Catholic, and so it always had a kind of right-to-life constituency. And the guy who ends up being the four-term mayor, Jimmy Griffin, is very passionately opposed to abortion. But the interesting thing about Buffalo, and it parallels very much what happened nationally, is that it's not just the Catholics. It turns out that the movement, the opposition to abortion, radicalized when born-again Christians entered the ranks. And so in Buffalo, you had these a Pentecostal church that whose ministers knew Randall Terry, the founder of Operation Rescue. And these people take things up a notch. They start doing civil disobedience. They start quoting the Bible, whereas in the 70s, the protesters were much more demure.
My guest is Eyal Press, E-Y-A-L-P-R-E-S-S. His book, Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict That Divided America, is published by Henry Holt. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And then there was the Canadian factor, wasn't there? The abortion debate seemed to spill across the border. Was abortion illegal at this time in Canada?
Well, before Roe, I interviewed a woman, Marilyn Buckham, who ran the clinic where Dr. Slepian worked, and she remembered women coming across the border from Canada into the United States. The more eerie Canadian connection that you brought up was in the aftermath of the murder. There was a newspaper, this was in 1998, a newspaper in Hamilton, Ontario, that received a threat saying, "My father was next on the list." There was this sense in the law enforcement community that shootings were occurring in and around the border. Some of them occurred in Canada because it was more difficult to trace.
So it didn't come as a surprise that violence broke out in Buffalo around abortion?
It came as a complete surprise to me. And in a way, I think that's probably some form of willful self-denial that
I
practiced.
How old were you at the time?
When the murder happened, I had graduated college and I was already a journalist. And it wasn't – the protests had begun when I was in high school. But through the 90s and even actually in the 80s, there was a fair amount of – there were bombings, there were threats and so forth. I did my best, I think like many people grow up and kind of hearing about these things, to ignore it and to try to think about this as something that happened elsewhere. And then shootings happened in Florida and so forth. But the reality was that the both the movement and the extreme wing of the movement were national phenomena.
And didn't Dr. Slepian warn that Buffalo might one day see an abortion provider shot? He wrote a letter to the Buffalo News in 1994, 4 years before he was shot.
Right. That's I actually didn't even know that that was true until after the murder. But then, of course, I rushed home to Buffalo afterwards and in the paper one day read that indeed in 1994, as the protests were still going on, Dr. Slepian writes a letter in which he says, look, people can protest as much as they want, but when you use terms like murderer and baby killer and you go to people's homes, as was the case in Buffalo, and not just their offices, but target them so directly and personally, that nobody should be surprised if it culminates in a violent act.
And that was 4 years before he was shot. So there had been the place had been boiling for quite a while. What was it like for you, the son of an abortion provider? First of all, was this something that was discussed over the dinner table?
No, and I think the reason it wasn't were complicated, but one of them is that my parents did their best to protect me and to shield me from the controversy. They didn't want me to, while I was in high school, get frightened or feel unsettled. That said, I was aware that it was happening because I could see with my own eyes. Again, I saw one day I was out. We had a little basketball hoop out on the driveway, and I was shooting baskets. And it was sort of early evening, and the protesters arrived and lit candles and prayed and so forth. And then, of course, I saw them outside my father's office when I drive by. It was right along the route to school, so I was aware of it, and it was creepy and at times, and I absorbed a certain amount of discomfort about the issue, maybe even a sense of shame, that even though I believed what my father was doing was right, I saw how dedicated he was to his patients. I knew he was a very dedicated physician. It still was very jarring, and so it had an effect.
Were you ever ostracized by fellow students? Because some children of abortion doctors have been screamed at, your father's a baby killer.
I never was, and that is true. Maybe if I'd been younger when it was all happening. The strange thing for me was I then went to college, and as the protests were sort of in full swing in Buffalo, I was in this kind of very sheltered pro-choice environment where people thought of people like my father as heroes. And, the strange thing for me was that it was almost as strange to hear the sort of hero talk as it was the kind of villain murderer talk, because to me he was simply my father and a doctor who just did what he did out of a sense of professional responsibility.
Well, they protected you at the time, but do you know now whether your father received many death threats throughout his career?
I know that he did receive them, and I know that patients of his received not death threats, but a degree of antagonistic and rhetoric and so forth that played a role in politicizing my father, so that he began very much with this kind of pragmatic approach to abortion. As he saw women enter his office in tears, sometimes seething in rage, he became more and more committed to what he was doing. His resolve deepened.
But he had to take these death threats seriously. Could he call the police for protection? Did he wear bulletproof vests, as some OBGYNs have?
Well, the protection came only after the murder, and it came after the death threat several people in the Buffalo area did receive federal marshal protection. But before that, it was not just the death threats, but the daily kind of turmoil that succeeded in doing something that has happened nationally, which is isolating abortion, making doctors very cognizant that if they were OBGYNs who had a general practice and they included abortion in that, as my father did, it was going to be a big headache.
Why do you think things turned violent in the mid-1990s? And we should make the point that it's only a very small fringe of the pro-life movement that advocates violence.
Absolutely. I mean, the book is full of interviews with opponents of abortion, and several of them referred to James Kopp, the guy who shot Barnett Slepian, as an imposter, as someone who how can you be pro-life and shoot someone? That's the mainstream sentiment within the movement.
Although Mr. Kopp would have said, by killing one person, I saved hundreds of lives, which
absolutely
is the argument given by the people who believe as he does.
Right. And indeed, I spoke to a supporter of his who came to the trial, who said he's not the imposter. It's the other people who are imposters, because like as in any movement, the violence comes in the mid-90s, not when the hopes are high, but when there's this sense of frustration and desperation. Operation Rescue, which had carried out the civil disobedience, collapses under court fines and injunctions. And you have a militant core that takes that and says, well, you know, we need to take this one step further. And of course, a precondition to that was that this was a movement that had defined things in very clear black and white terms, good and bad, good and evil, right and wrong, and that endorsed and sanctioned breaking the law. So you have the militants within that movement saying, well, if we can break the law, and if they're not going to let us do civil disobedience, then let's take it one step further.
My guest is A.L. Press. His book, Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict That Divided America, is published by Henry Holt. He is a journalist based in New York City, a regular contributor to The Nation, whose work has also appeared in The Atlantic Monthly and The New York Times Magazine. We will continue right after this. We're back with A.L. Press. His book, Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict That Divided America, is published by Henry Holt. So you obviously, by writing this book, decided that you wanted to understand why people felt driven to take extreme measures. Do you see it ultimately as a political issue or a religious one?
I see it as both, and actually my interest wasn't only in why people went to extreme measures. I was also very interested in the story of Buffalo, which closely parallels the story of America in this sense. When I was growing up in Buffalo, the big story was not abortion. It was plant closings and job losses, the deindustrialization of the Rust Belt that had a traumatic impact on many communities there. And out of that, you might expect, if you're not familiar with American politics over the last 30 years, you might think, well, the protests will be about jobs or a more equitable economic system or, whatever it is, unemployment benefits. Instead, the a decade later, you have protests around the fate of the plight of the unborn. And in that sense, Buffalo closely parallels America as a whole. You have a cultural populism that emerges in which there are church-going working-class people taking to the streets because of what's wrong with morality.
And you've written in the New York Times about parallels with the 9/11 terrorists. In what ways?
Well, that's sort of in the when things do go to an extreme. I talk in the book about how one of the ironies is there are all these shootings taking place targeting abortion providers in the mid 90s. My father, who comes from Israel, pays closest attention in the mid 90s to a different shooting, and that's the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, who he admired and who actually knew my grandfather personally. And at the time. We didn't really talk about the parallel, but there clearly is a parallel in that you have this new, what some scholars are now calling sacred terrorism, these acts of violence that grow out of a very extreme fundamentalist faith in which a hunger for purity combined with a sense of frustration and impotence that the world is not being remade in accordance with God's will leads people to act violently.
Does your father have strong feelings about the right to an abortion as a moral issue, or was it simply a medical matter for him?
It started out as a medical matter. He was in Israel where abortion was actually illegal when he was doing his medical training. But at the same time, it was widely practiced, and it was practiced because of the reality that unplanned, unwanted pregnancies happen. And so he took a kind of pragmatic rather than ideological approach at the time to what he saw, that this was something that as a society, hopefully we do what we can to minimize, to prevent unplanned pregnancies from happening. But he also saw what a cross-section of women, both in Israel and then later in Buffalo, did have pregnancy terminations. So it started out that way. Then his politics kind of developed.
Do you know if he ever felt troubled about performing abortions?
I don't think he felt troubled. I think that he does, you know, he views late-term abortions as something that, again, we would hope to be able to eliminate so that, you know, in his ideal world, we do what we can to teach people about the consequences of sex, about contraception and so forth. And the abortions that do take place are early-term abortions.
South Dakota, which just outlawed all abortions, almost all abortions, there's just a minor exception, I guess it's the health of the mother, only has one county with one abortion clinic, one in the whole state. I think the same is true for Mississippi. And you write that between 1992 and 2000, more than 250 hospitals and 300 private practitioners across the country stopped performing abortions. So does that mean that the pro-life protests have been working?
Well, I think that the protests had a big impact. I think now the transformation of the Republican Party and the growing prominence of the religious right within it is definitely having an impact. What I think is interesting is that there's so much focus on the fate of Roe. You know, will it be upheld? Will it be overturned? To some degree, you already see the kind of checkered pattern which you just described in America, so that you have states where access is such an issue that you know, that the majority of women are traveling out of state already, in Wyoming, for example, and in Mississippi, to have abortions. So to some degree, Roe's legitimacy problem, the fact that some states and some communities simply have never accepted its legitimacy, has already resulted in a kind of federalization of this issue.
New York Magazine had an article in which they said that New York City is the abortion capital of the East Coast. I guess Los Angeles is of the West Coast. Do you think that other doctors decided that even if they would have preferred to have continued to perform abortions, it wasn't worth dying for?
Definitely. And not just, I don't know if they'd limit it to that, but also just the dealing with the pressure, dealing with potentially having your practice completely interfered with. My father in the late 80s, when the protests start targeting his office, and remember, most of the patients he's seeing don't come in for abortions. So he has a really serious question on his hands. Should he continue doing this, given that it's affecting not just women who are coming for pregnancy terminations, but every patient he sees, and he's in the news and so forth. He was also working some days at a group practice at the time. Every doctor there was pro-choice. They didn't want to do abortions there, and the reason was, you know, they saw what was happening.
So what made him so determined to keep on providing abortions with all of those other reasons not to?
I think in part it was this mentality of his, this kind of determined Israeli, you know, the harder you pushed him, the more resolved he became. I think also it was what he witnessed, and again, the sort of the politicization through real direct experience.
Why do you think that the threats have stopped, or have they stopped?
I think that, again, I described the mid-90s as this period of desperation and futility that led people to decide, well, we have to take the law into our own hands. We can't trust the courts. We can't trust Congress. We can't trust the president. That's probably still true of the extreme wing of the movement. But the mainstream right-to-life movement has very high hopes right now, and high hopes for good reason.
But if Roe v. Wade is overturned, and there's a possibility, still New York and California, some other states will continue providing them, that probably will once again stir things up. People who are opposed to abortion now will be able to focus on only a few major cities.
Right. Well, it certainly wouldn't end the conflict. It would probably turn one big conflict into disparate ones that exist in various states.
My guest is Eyal Press, E-Y-A-L. His book, Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict That Divided America, is published by Henry Holt. Can we say that your father had a typical patient who was seeking an abortion? I realize that abortion seekers were only a small portion of his practice, but did they come from the full range, rich, poor, black, white?
They did, and one of the more striking things I came across in researching Buffalo. First of all, I thought that it was the fact that the city was Catholic that led to the protest. That turned out to be too simple. Secondly, I thought, well, the women having abortions are not from the Catholic community. In 1979, there was a study done of one of the patients who came to one of the clinics in Buffalo. It turned out that the percentage of women who were Catholic who came for abortions was slightly higher than in the city as a whole. And, you know, so the stereotypes we have of, well, it's only these people, it's not others, turn out not to hold out. On the other hand, there are socioeconomic patterns, particularly now that access has become an issue. Women both in Buffalo and in other states who have the least access to contraception and sex education, so forth, in lower socioeconomic groups are overrepresented in terms of the abortion rate.
Did he ever feel that the women he saw didn't take abortion seriously enough?
You know, I think he did on occasion, and that's...
'Cause some women did use it as contraception, and this is a very serious matter.
Right, and I mean, it was interesting. I spent a couple of days at my father's office on days abortions were performed, and I noticed and saw through my own eyes just what an emotional and what an often conflicted decision it can be. And it really it was difficult for me. And I came home that one night and I said to my father, you know, isn't this difficult sometimes just to see on an emotional level? And what he said was very interesting. He said, actually, the difficult thing to see was not a woman who took the decision very seriously and agonized and really thought it through, but rather the occasional patient who came in and acted as though it wasn't a big deal. Now, all the patients he sees, and I think this is true at the other places in Buffalo as well, go through a counseling session and, you know, contraception is discussed and so forth. But look, it's the real world, and, you know, there are some people who do have, you know, who don't always think through the consequences and maybe pay for it down the road in terms of an emotional impact.
You're right about one protester you spoke with who carried around pictures of children she'd saved by convincing their mothers not to go through with their abortions.
Right. That was Mickey Vandeven, a sidewalk counselor who's still active in Buffalo. And I met with her one day, and she showed me the photographs of what she called saves. And
how does she know?
She told me that these were women who were on their way to have abortions. They stopped to talk to her. They took a pamphlet. They had a conversation, and they turned back, and they didn't carry through. And meeting her was a very intense experience because I'd grown up with this image of the kind of abortion opponent as, first of all, as a man, not as a woman, and an angry and very in-your-face man who's, you know, got clutched a Bible in one hand and a protest sign in the other and wants to make his point as loudly and abrasively as possible. Mickey Vandeven turns out to be this incredibly soft-spoken woman who, you know, during our interview, I had to strain to hear her talk and so forth. So meeting her, meeting some other people was a challenge to some of my own assumptions.
But most of the protesters devote an awful lot of time, people like Mickey, to picketing, to going to abortion clinics to convince people not to. Is this what they see as their profession?
Mickey Vandeven described it not as a profession but as a calling. And so in the sense that you asked, is this a religious or political issue, the religion is central and central for her. It's central for the other activists I met.
You never met an atheist who was opposed to abortion?
I didn't interview an atheist who was really active in the Right to Life movement, although there are some. In the early years, back in the 70s, one of the interesting things is that the Republican-Democrat split on abortion hadn't yet occurred. So in New York State, for example, as I talk about in the book, you have Governor Rockefeller, a Republican, signing this law legalizing abortion here. And you had a lot of Catholic Democrats and working-class Democrats from who were Catholic who were opposed to abortion.
Is your father still practicing in Buffalo?
He is.
What will happen when he retires? Are there still a lot of other doctors doing this?
Well, what there aren't are doctors who include abortion in as part of a broader practice. So in that sense, he's very much of a kind of a fading generation of physicians who maybe entered before there was this realization that, well, if you make this decision, you're going to face, you know, the stigma and the turmoil and the pressure and so forth.
He just thought it was normal medical practice when he started and then discovered that he was involved in something quite bigger.
Right, and sort of wandered into it unknowingly. And you can't really do that these days. And the other major trend, in addition to fewer providers, is the isolation of abortion from the rest of medical practice. So you do have places in Buffalo and throughout Western New York where women can go. You have a clinic in Buffalo. You have a Planned Parenthood in Niagara Falls. You have some places in Rochester, which is an hour away. But most of those places are exclusively doing not the Planned Parenthood, but the clinic certainly, doing abortions. And this has been, I think, from my father's perspective and many physicians, an unfortunate thing, that you have this thing that's so isolated that it's not seen as part of medicine. It's not taught at a lot of medical schools.
Before Roe v. Wade, you said a lot of people coming to Buffalo and other cities, especially in New York, from out of town. Now that it's harder to get an abortion in many places, are we starting to see that again?
Well, there's definitely been an increase in a number of states of the percentage of women who are traveling across state lines to get abortions. Wyoming is one of them, Mississippi, I think North Carolina. There's been a kind of documented trend in this regard.
But what about in Buffalo? Are people starting to come in from Pennsylvania and elsewhere?
Not that I'm aware of, but, you know, I do think that if Roe is overturned and it goes back to the states, then we'll see that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that most people see that as inevitable.
Well, I think that
maybe not with this Supreme Court, because it's still maybe 5-4, but somewhere down the line.
I think that there's certainly a very reasonable expectation that Roe will be chipped away at. In terms of outright overturning Roe, That's a little more difficult to say. On the other hand, you know, there's no question that the fears of the pro-choice community are very high, and the hopes of the opponents of abortion are very high.
You are a journalist whose father is an OBGYN who performs abortion, along with all the other things that he does. So this book is a logical outcome, a logical result of your life, the two things that have happened in your life. What happens when this book is published and you have to write about other things? What else have you been writing about?
Well, to tell you the truth, I welcome that thought to some degree, given that, as I said, when I started out as a journalist, I didn't want to write about abortion. And I think one of the reasons for that is that I'd seen up close, maybe closer than most people, just the intensity of the emotional, the feelings around it. The murder changed that in the sense that I felt I could no longer – I had to – try to figure out what had coalesced to produce this and why in this country, of all the countries out there, abortion has reached has such a central role in our politics and such a uniquely polarizing one, which is not the case in France, not the case in Italy, not the case in many other countries. Having kind of gone through the process and I hope produced a book that will engage people and get them talking rather than yelling, I look forward to turning my attention to other things.
AL Press will be reading and signing books tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store at Astor Place and on Wednesday the 22nd at the National Arts Club at 7:30. That's on Gramercy Park. There's also another appearance in April, which you can find all about on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of the Leonard LoPage Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.